Okay, so we've been looking at texts in the Buddhist tradition, and we've been looking at the very rich part of the Buddhist tradition, which is the Pali Canon, the original teachings of the Buddha. And this week I'm going to look at a particular Pali Sutta called the Simile of the Saw. And so this is taken from the Majjhima Nikaya, which is a great book of the Buddha's discourses. And what's really good about it is that the Majjhima Nikaya means they're middle-length sayings. So they're not too long and they're not too short. They're just right. So that's why the Majjhima Nikaya is so good, because they're just the right length. And the Majjhima Nikaya is full of really good things. I haven't read it all, and I'm going to read it all before I die. I think that's my thing that I'm going to do. And it's full of things. Some of them are called, for example, the Sutta on Fear and Dread. Don't know what that's about. A Sutta on If a Practitioner Should Wish. The Discourse on the Lion's Roar, and there's the shorter and longer version of the Lion's Roar. There's the Sutta on the Wilderness in the Heart, and the Simile of the Elephant's Footprints, just to name but a few. So it's very exciting, the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's full of untold treasures about wildernesses of in the heart, which is, sounds great. So, but my current favourite, I have to say, is the Simile of the Saw. And, I came across this the other day, and I was just so excited. Because, well, partly because it's about metta. So anything that's about metta, it just seems really exciting to me. And it's not just about metta, it's about how far metta can really go. Because I think I'm starting to realise that I have a really impoverished view of the how far metta can go. You know, I think in a way, in my head, somehow where I've got this idea that metta is just about being nice. Or it's just about having a nice metta bhavana. So you kind of feel a bit, you know, groovy at the end of it. A bit kind of a bit warmer, you know, at the end of it. And actually, this sutta is quite challenging. Well, it's very challenging, actually. But what it shows is, well, where metta can go, the real heights of metta. And where your practice of metta is heading. And I find that very, very inspiring. You know, that metta isn't just about having a kind of warm, fluffy experience on your cushion. It's not even just about having better relationships with people. It's this sutta really propels you into a vision of something much, much more. The real heights of metta. The real heights of metta is much more than this kind of, you know, nice or, you know, even just friendliness. The heights of metta is being like the great earth. It's being like infinite space, like a great river, and like a catskin bag. So all will be revealed. So suddenly this slightly obscure handout starts to make a little bit of sense. Anyway, so the Simile of the Saw, it starts off as discourses of the Buddha on metta often do. It starts off with a dispute. It starts off with disharmony. And the disharmony is this. There's a disciple of the Buddha called Mollya. And Mollya becomes very close to the bhikkhunis. So the bhikkhunis, it basically means the female followers of the Buddha. And you could say nuns, but I think when you talk about monks and nuns in the Pali Canon, you can get the wrong idea. You can get this image of, sort of Southeast Asian nuns of the present day with very clean shaved heads, very clean robed, living in big buildings of monasteries and sort of very mindfully walking down the street in pairs. And actually, I think the nuns of the time of the Buddha, the female followers of the Buddha at the time of the Buddha, would have been very different. Some of you might have been at Gukhya Vajra's talk when he talked about the original followers of the Buddha. Well, for a start, they didn't have razors. I didn't realise this. I didn't really think about it. But they didn't have razors. So when they shaved their head, they just got a knife and got their fingers and just hacked off their hair. So I think probably what they would have looked... They wouldn't have had kind of standardised robes, you know, all dyed in the same colour and sewn together with sewing machines. They really would have been wearing rags. I mean, and I think some of those rags would have been taken from debris of rags from a cremation ground, you know. So they would have been basically looking like a bunch of tramps, you know, slightly smelly, very rough-looking tramps. So when I say the bhikkhunis or the nuns, don't get this idea of these kind of very clean people walking down the street. They really would have been very... It was a very edgy thing to do, particularly for a woman at the time of the Buddha. And, yeah, they were more like wandering renunciants rather than nuns as we think of them today. So anyway, so Mollier becomes a friend of the bhikkhunis. But the problem is he gets a bit too close. And he gets into this dynamic with them that if anyone speaks critically of the bhikkhunis, he rushes to their defence and he shouts at whoever's criticising them. And if anyone criticises Mollier to the bhikkhunis, they rush to his defence and they start shouting at the person who criticises him. And what develops is this kind of defended group within the Sangha. So you can see it's quite easy to set that up, actually. You can kind of imagine it now, that we get a group of friends within the Sangha. And we won't... And, you know, in a way, well, that's really good. It's good to have a group of friends. But then we can get to a stage where that's a bit inappropriate and we can start to get angry if someone criticises our friends. So we become a bit like, you know, this group of friends' bodyguard or something. And you can see it when people are like, you know, they're really, really, oh, this is my mate. And if you talk like that about my mate, I'm going to get you, you know. Which is actually inappropriate behaviour in the Sangha. Having a defended group within the Sangha is inappropriate. Well, it's good to develop friendships. But becoming your friend's defender in that inappropriate way, well, isn't good. It's anger. It's still anger, even if it's your friend. Even if the person was a bit out of order when they criticised your friend, it's still anger. You're still responding with anger. So there's this defended group with Mollier and the bhikkhunis. And the Buddha calls Mollier to him and he checks it out with them. He says, look, this is what I've heard. Is this true? So I think that as a first point is very interesting because the Buddha always checks it out. The Buddha never, ever takes second-hand information. He doesn't go right in there with Mollier and say, right, you know, you've got to sort yourself out. This is what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. He always says, well, look, what's going on? And he gets it from the person himself. He doesn't just go straight into judgment. So the Buddha asks Mollier what's been going on. And Mollier tells him, you know, he's good, Mollier. At least he kind of says, yeah, no, that is true. I have been rushing to their defence. I have been defending them. I have been rebuking anyone who criticises them. And then the Buddha asks Mollier, he says, well, look, Mollier, have you gone forth from the home life or the worldly life into homelessness? And Mollier says, well, yes. And the Buddha says, well, what the Buddha does, and it's quite interesting because he equates desire and ill will and anger with the worldly or household life and responding with metta as the homeless life. Responding with metta as a way from moving away from the worldly life, from moving a way of moving away from the household life. So I think that's interesting because I think a big question for us, or a big paradox for us even, is in living, practicing Buddhism in the modern world, is that most of us don't live a homeless life. Most of us live in the world, we've got families, we've got jobs. We've got a home, we've got a house even. And a big question for us is, well, how can I really take to heart the Buddha's teaching? How can I really move away from a worldly life while still living in the world? How can I remain in the world but be less worldly in a way? And this is an answer to it. And the Buddha's answer to it in the simile of the saw is, well, if you want to live a homeless life, then you've got to respond to situations with metta. Metta is a way of living the homeless life. And if you're living the worldly life, well, then you respond with ill will and desire. So I think that's something we can reflect on. If you want to be more of a Buddhist in your everyday life, be more of you know, aspire more towards being a disciple of the Buddha. Even if you can't leave all your situation behind, even if you can't leave your family, you're not going to leave your house, you're not going to leave your job, well, can you cultivate metta? Because cultivating metta is moving away from the worldly life. Cultivating metta in this context is moving away from the household life. So yes, yeah, so the Buddha tells Mollya to leave behind the worldly life and train in metta. And he says to Mollya, he says, well, whatever anyone does to the bhikkhunis, whatever anyone does to you, even if they hit you, even if they stab you, even if they hit the bhikkhunis, even if they stab the bhikkhunis, you should train in metta in all situations by repeating the phrase, my mind will not be affected, and I shall utter no unskillful words. I shall abide compassionate for his or her welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. So I'll repeat that again. My mind will not be affected, and I shall utter no unskillful words. I shall abide compassionate for his or her welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. So what's interesting about this is that I think what the Buddha meant was that really you take this literally as a phrase that you memorize, and that in a situation where someone speaks unskillfully to you or does something unskillful to you, you repeat it in your mind. So you learn it and you repeat it. When anyone does something you don't want them to do, you repeat this in your mind. And what that does is it gives you a space to respond with metta. You could almost look at it like a mindfulness practice to stay in the gap. I don't know if you remember this from your beginner's course, but you can look at it as a way of, okay, well, someone does something you don't like, but instead of rushing into a reaction, instead of shouting at them or even being violent towards them, you stop and you repeat this phrase to yourself. You take it on as a kind of meditation in your everyday life. It's a way of prolonging your metta bhavana practice in your everyday life. And it's a very, very useful practical tool, particularly if you're of a bit of an angry temperament. So I've had this a lot. I when I worked in the shop, they used to call me the vortex of darkness. Because I used to get in such bad moods that I used to kind of be this dark vortex and just suck everything in into my own grumpiness. And I had to take on this practice that every time I felt angry with someone, every time someone said something that irritated me, I'd have to go and walk around the block. And what was really interesting about that is, okay, so first of all, I just take my vortex of darkness somewhere else. Maybe the fresh air would calm it down a bit. But after a while, I didn't even have to leave the shop because reminding myself, okay, I'm going to snap at someone in a minute, I have to leave, actually reminded me that the main thing was that it reminded me that it wasn't their fault, that actually it helped me take responsibility for my own mental states. So what this phrase does is it's saying, well, don't blame them. Actually take it on, well, okay, they've done all sorts of things, but how am I going to respond? And doing a phrase like that actually stops you from reacting and helps you to act creatively. It stops you from going to immediate response of ill will, shouting, or even violence, and makes you stop and think. It stops you from blaming other people, and it helps you to take responsibility for your own mental states. So you could see it as quite a practical tool to use, particularly if you are a bit of a vortex of darkness, as some people are on occasion. So that's what the Buddha advises Mollya to do. But what I think is also interesting about this advice of the Buddha is what's interesting is what he doesn't tell Mollya to do, what he doesn't mention. And he doesn't mention two things. One of the things is he doesn't mention anything about the politics of the situation. He doesn't say, well, who started it? Or, well, what did they say? Or, you know, well, are you justified in rushing into their defence? He doesn't sort of go into that. He doesn't go into the whole thing of who said what and how they said it and when they said it and, you know, was it kind and all the rest of it. He doesn't get into any of those politics. It doesn't matter. What matters to the Buddha is responding with metta, whatever people do to you. It doesn't matter who started it. It doesn't matter what they said. It doesn't matter what they did. You always respond with metta. So he just completely cuts out the whole politics of the situation and just says, okay, well, they're going to act unskillfully even sometimes, but what are you going to do about it? How can you respond with metta? And the second thing that the Buddha doesn't do is that he doesn't tell Mollya how to act. He doesn't tell Mollya what to do after he has brought to mind this phrase of loving kindness. All the Buddha asks Mollya to do is just cultivate metta. Just bring metta to mind. Just come from a place of metta. Because what you do, how you act overtly, doesn't really matter. The main thing is that you do it out of metta. So the Buddha doesn't say to Mollya, okay, so someone is really rude about the bhikkhunis, and you bring this phrase to mind, and then what you've got to do is you've got to sit them down and you've got to tell them that they're out of order and that they've got to change and all the rest of it. He doesn't go into any of that. He just says, bring metta to mind. So I think there's a real confidence of the Buddha that actually if you bring metta to mind, if you really cultivate a mind of loving kindness, if you abide compassionate for someone's welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate, you'll be all right. He's got confidence in whatever Mollya does, as long as he brings to mind loving kindness, as long as he abides compassionate for other people's welfare, what you do will then just follow out of that. So I think that's quite interesting, because we can really bound up, you know, someone says this to me, well, what do I, you know, I've got to have some response. You know, when I was younger and used to walk down the street and, you know, you get sort of lads being a bit rude or builders being a bit rude. And then I always used to think of the really good cracking thing to say about half an hour after I'd left them. And I would be really mad because I'd think, oh, I should have said that, and that would have really got them in the morning. And actually, it was a bit of a relief when I got older and I thought, well, it doesn't really matter how you respond. It doesn't really matter what you say. The main thing is to not react. The main thing is to abide in a mental state of loving kindness, whatever people say. So you don't have to say anything clever. You don't have to do anything really clever. You know, you don't have to be, you know, some kind of martial arts person and sort everybody out or anything like that. You just have to abide in loving kindness, and your actions will naturally follow from that. So then the Buddha goes on to tell a rather amusing story about Mistress Vedika and the rolling pin. So once upon a time, in ancient India, there was a maidservant called Kali and her mistress, Vedika. And Mistress Vedika was known as being very kind, very gentle and very peaceful. And she had this really good reputation. You can kind of imagine it, you know, this... maybe she was probably quite wealthy if she had a maid servant. And, you know, she had this really good reputation of being a very, very kind person. And her maid servant wondered. She looked at her and wondered, and she thought, well, okay, she doesn't show any anger. But does that mean that anger's not present? Or is it just that she doesn't show it? So Kali decides to test her mistress. So one day, she gets up a little late. And Mistress Vedika comes to her and she says, well, what's the matter? And Kali goes, nothing. And Mistress Vedika says, nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up later in the day. And then she gets angry and she scowls. Okay, so Kali thought, okay, well, that's interesting that she scowled and she's got angry. So I'm going to test her a little bit further. So the next day, she gets up even later. And you can imagine now that Mistress Vedika is starting to wear a little thin. And she comes in to Kali and she says, what's the matter? And Kali says, nothing. She goes, nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up later in the day. And she gets angry and then she starts shouting. So Kali says, well, that's interesting, isn't it? So much for being kind and gentle and peaceful. So Kali decides the next day to get up even later. And Mistress Vedika comes in and she says, what's the matter? And Kali says, nothing. And she says, "Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up later in the day." And then she gets a rolling pin and starts beating her on the head. And Carly gets a massive gash in the head. The blood is running down her face, soaking all her clothes. And she runs through the market saying, "Well, look at Mistress Vedika now. See the gentle Mistress Vedika. See the kind Mistress Vedika. See the peaceful Mistress Vedika. See the kind, gentle, peaceful lady's work." And she's covered in blood. So Mistress Vedika's reputation understandably changes from that day off. And Mistress Vedika is known as being rough, violent and merciless. So the Buddha relates this story, and you can kind of imagine all these monks, they're sitting around laughing, you know, maybe the Buddha did actually have a rolling pin. And maybe he chased the monks around with a rolling pin, who knows. But I didn't even know that they had rolling pins in ancient India, but there we go. So it's a bit of a joke. He does this bit of a joke, and you can kind of imagine all these monks laughing. And but then the Buddha says, after they're all laughing, "So too, bhikkhus. Some bhikkhu is extremely kind, extremely gentle, extremely peaceful, so long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch him. But when it is disagreeable courses of speech, but when disagreeable courses of speech touch him, it can be understood whether that bhikkhu is really kind, gentle, and peaceful." So he brings it back to the monastic sangha, the followers of the Buddha, and he says to them, you know, okay, well, that's a funny story, but what about you? You know, it can look like someone's very kind, very gentle, very peaceful, until they're tested, until someone speaks unjustly or unkindly or even just disagreeably to them. And that it's only then that you're really going to understand whether they are kind, gentle and peaceful. So I think this is story of the Buddha's is quite interesting, because what he's saying is that we need to test our metta. It's not enough to just do our quota of the metta bhavana. You know, like, okay, so we do our mindfulness and our metta, one day mindfulness, one day metta, or you know, depending on how much you meditate, it could be one day mindfulness, 3 days later, metta. But you know, and you think, oh, that's good. I've done my metta bhavana today. I'm doing all right, you know. It's not enough to just do our quota of the metta bhavana. We need to test it out. We need to put it into effect. And, well, what is the arena for testing our metta? The arena for testing our metta is living beings. It's other beings. Because in a way you could look at this, other beings really are our final frontier. You know, we've explored space, we've explored the depths of the oceans, and I think as Buddhists it's now time to explore the final frontier, which is another human being. Those strange and fathomless creatures, just when you think you've got another human being sussed, they do something completely weird and completely out of character. They are irrational, irrepressible, irresponsible, irrevocable, inscrutable, ridiculous, repugnant, and rude. But at the same time, they are also full of great mystery, full of wonder, surprises, beauty, and when you least expect it, other human beings show immense kindness and generosity. They're wonderful beings. And the more you get to know another human being, the more you know that you don't know them at all. The more you get a sense of this absolute wonder. I mean, what are they doing? I don't even know what I'm doing most of the time, but other human beings, complete mystery. You know, you can describe, I love the way that particularly Buddhists, I don't know if it's sort of everyone does this, but it does seem very common in Buddhist circles to do these wonderful psychoanalysis on people very quickly, you know. So this sort of pop psychology of why people do the things that they do. Oh, well, you know, it's because, you know, they didn't have a boyfriend till they were 25 or something. And you think, what are you, Freud, all of a sudden? You know, we like to make these little theories about people. We like to get them all kind of sussed out and what they're like. But actually, human beings are a mystery. They are a true mystery. And you know, they'll do things that we just don't expect all the time. When we think we've got them sussed, we think we've got them kind of parceled up and portioned out, they'll just do something completely at odds with our expectations. And how amazing and how wonderful. What an opportunity that is. Because there are these human beings that are around us all the time that help us train and cultivate metta all the time. And it's wonderful that people don't do what we want. Otherwise, we'd never have an opportunity to test our metta. So I think what we've got to ask ourselves is, well, in what context do we really come into contact with the final frontier? In what context do we really explore that final frontier? Where do we meet others and where do we test our metta? So another way of looking at this will be to ask yourself the question, well, where do people really wind me up? Where do I feel most angry? Where can I see myself getting that phrase of the Buddha's and just repeating it again and again and again and again and again, clinging on to a little ounce of metta? You know, where is your metta working ground? And I was thinking about this. I think for most of us, our real metta working ground is our family context and our work situation. How wonderful. How wonderful. You've all got it made. They're just there to help you practice metta. And another place you might come across it is also in the Sangha. It depends how much time you know, you might spend just enough time here to kind of think, well, people are basically friendly and all right. But you might have got to that stage now where people really annoy you, even in the Buddhist centre. And I say, well, jolly good, that is. How wonderful for you. That's just what you needed. So, so the Sangha can be a real working ground, particularly on retreat, actually, I think, as well. Because what's great about retreat is you go and then you share a bedroom with someone you've never met in your life before, and you get up really early with them. Or for some of us, it will be you go to bed really late with them, or early, or whatever it is. And so suddenly you're brought right into the kind of domestic situation with someone you've never met before. So you go in these domestic situations, and then what happens is that you're also in a group with them. So you just spend all day with this person. And it's great. It's really good. In fact, I sometimes do a practice, which I probably shouldn't tell you about, but I'm going to anyway, which is that when I'm on retreat, I usually put myself in groups of people I don't like. If I think there's someone that sort of slightly winds me up, I think, good. So if I ever go on in a group with you on retreat, I think it's a good experiment. So it's good to think of these situations, because sometimes we can think of these situations as places, oh, well, I can't do metta there. You know, this is not my Buddhist time. My Buddhist time is when I come to the Buddhist centre. My Buddhist time is when I meditate, either at home or here. My Buddhist time is on retreat. But for the rest of the time, it's just like this kind of, you know, well, this kind of blank space, you know. But actually, you can look at those situations, family and work, as places where you can really test out your metta. Well, this is your real working ground. This is where you can really cultivate metta. And look at those times as very, very special and a very good opportunity. Because you're guaranteed that if you spend long enough with someone, they just won't do what you want them to do. And when that happens, you can think to yourself, well, this is really good for me, because now I can put my metta into practice. Now I can really test out my metta. It's a bit like this is probably a bit inappropriate analogy, but never mind. It's a bit like, you know, you go into a boxing club and then you do all this training on those funny bags with springs and everything. And you're doing all this training, and then one day the trainer says to you, you can come in the ring and actually box with a real human being. And you'd be like, yeah, great, okay, I get to test out all my training. You know, and so you could think about families and work in that kind of situation. You've been doing all this metta bhavana, now you can really test it in the world. But don't box at the same time. That was a different different analogy. So in the, you might have heard of this, but in the FWBO, we have what's called team-based right livelihood business enterprises. And they're very longhand for saying that, at a certain point, well, lots of Buddhist businesses were set up, including the Evolution Shop in town. And the whole idea of this was, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all work together and test our metta out with people who were also testing their metta out? It could be a really productive working ground, which it is, actually, because work is such an important area for people. It's where we spend most of our working, most of our waking life. So if we could really get a handle on cultivating metta in those situations, well, you know, think of the speediness of your liberation. You know, it'd be like I'm doing the metta bhavana all day, every day. So that's why things like the Evolution Shop were set out. You know, it's hard, actually. It's hard, and you don't get away with anything as well, because people will come up to you and they'll say, you know, I don't think that your response was very metaful yesterday. And then you've got to sort it out with them. But that's really good. It's a real opportunity. If you can ever get a chance to work in the Evolution Shop or go on a Karuna appeal or work in any kind of Buddhist context, even work in Buddha Field for a festival in the cafe or something like that. If you can do that, it's a very exciting opportunity because you can really test out your metta with other people who are also testing out their metta. Practice ethics with people who are practicing ethics. It's a very, very good opportunity. And the other way that we can test our metta is in the metta bhavana itself. So in the metta bhavana, as you know, we have five stages. And those stages are there for a reason. Because I've come across this a few times, that people let go of the stages. And sometimes they even say, well, you know, I just wish metta to anyone who floats into my mind. And anyone who comes to mind, I'll just wish them metta. Well, that might be okay. But the stages of the metta bhavana are there to put you into contact with people that you'd actually rather avoid. People who don't float into your mind because you don't even realise that they exist. So stages of the metta bhavana are a way of confronting you with reality, with the reality of your own metta. You get people you like, people you don't know, and people you don't like. And you can see that as really, okay, well, you know, how much can I test my metta in different situations? You can see those stages of the metta bhavana as a real training ground for metta. And sometimes in that training ground, you'll fall flat on your face. You know, sometimes it's like, okay, I can feel metta to my friend, I can feel metta to someone I don't know, but really this person is the limit. I just can't do it. I'm sorry, I don't care what Vajratara says, I just can't do it. Well, in a way, that's all right. You've just come up against a bit of a limitation in your training ground. Or sometimes the stage is actually yourself. You know, it doesn't even get further than that. It's just like, no, this is where I just draw the line here. With myself and the mood I'm in today, forget it. That's okay. You know, what we're trying to do, the metta bhavana is a training ground. It might be that you fall flat on your face one day, but actually what can also happen is you can see that situations where you never thought you could do it, you can. And maybe each time you do the metta bhavana, you make that metta just a little bit more universal. You just go beyond yourself that little bit more. And maybe you won't even realise that until you get up from your metta bhavana and start actually going into the training ground of other living beings. You know, we're incapable of real greatness, human beings. Even on an everyday level, we're really capable of greatness. We're really capable of putting those difficulties aside. Putting aside the just sheer unknown quantity of another human being and actually being able to relate to people. You know, we are capable of that, and we all have had experiences of that. And what the metta bhavana does is it trains you so you can do that more and more. So, you know, sometimes I think people with their metta bhavana, they put a bit of a glass ceiling on it. You know, they say, well, I can do this much and no more. Well, you can do much more than that. You can do much more than you think you can. You know, even quite quickly when you start to meditate. People are incredible, actually. That's what I find more and more. We can really do things that we didn't think were possible. So don't undervalue yourself, you know, and don't undervalue the power of the metta bhavana. Anyway. So the Buddha goes on to talk about more and more about this vision of metta and the possibilities of metta. And the Buddha says, people will say all sorts of things. You know, their speech may be timely or untimely. It may be true, it may be untrue. It may be gentle, it may be harsh, it may be connected with good or with harm, it may be spoken with a mind of metta or with inner hate. It doesn't matter. However people speak to you, you always respond with metta. So that list of speech is quite common in the Pali Canon, and some of you will have heard it before. It's the kind of five categories of speech, and it's very useful. He usually talks about it in terms of how to say criticism skillfully. He says if you want to say something that's a bit of a criticism, then you should say it should be timely, it should be true, it should be gentle, it should be connected with the good, and it should be spoken with a mind of metta. So I just thought I'd flag that up because some of you might be familiar with that list. And in a way, it's worth a whole talk in itself. But it's a list that comes up again and again. It's kind of advice for how to speak. But what the Buddha's saying in the simile of the saw is he's saying that people won't always do that. They won't always say the right thing. Sometimes they will speak unskillfully. It doesn't matter. You always respond with metta. And he says, whatever anyone says to you, you go back to this training phrase. But at this point in the sutta, he extends it. And he says, well, this is what you say to yourself. Whatever anyone says to you, if you find yourself, you know, ready to bubble over with anger, ready to have a harsh response, go back to this phrase. He says, say to yourself, our minds will remain unaffected and we shall utter no unskillful words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of metta, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with metta, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So you may have, you have got this that written on your handout. So what he's saying is, learn that off by heart. Learn it and apply it in situations. And it's very, very powerful exercise to do. Apart from anything else, it's quite long. So by the time you've recited it, you've calmed down a bit, which is a good thing, isn't it, really? So I've just got a few things to say about that phrase. And the first thing is he talks about a mind imbued with metta. And mind in this is a translation of chitta. What that means is a mind heart. It's talking about your mind. It can also mean your heart. So when he says a mind imbued with metta, he's not saying just have the thoughts of metta. He's not talking about an intellectual idea of metta. He's talking about have that mind, have your heart mind imbued with metta. Have the center of your being imbued with metta. He's saying, you know, come from the depths of metta. Come from, because I think that's what we do. If we're talking about the depths of our being and we try to locate it, well, we'll say here, it's in our heart. And that in Buddhism is the chitta, it's the heart mind. So it's not about just having a thought of metta while you're seething underneath. That might be where it starts. But actually saying a mind imbued with metta is a being imbued with metta. It means coming from the depths of your being with metta. Metta in the depths of your being. And, you know, pervade the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with metta, with a mind imbued with metta. It's like saying, really come at it with the depths of your being, not just as an intellectual idea, but as a real motivating force. You know, chitta is meant to be where your motivation comes from. So the motivating force in your life should be one of metta. And he says, a mind imbued with metta, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So I think this is really fascinating because the Buddha is a bit like Sangharakshita, really. He doesn't say any word without meaning it. And I was looking at these three words, abundant. First of all, abundant. And abundant, well, it means overflowing with metta, rich with metta. You don't have to portion out metta out. There's not a kind of impoverished view of metta where, you know, oh, well, if I give this much to you, then I won't have very much left for myself. Or if I give this much to you, then I won't be able to give this much to you. He's saying get rid of all that idea, because the thing about metta is the more you give, the more you have. You don't need to store up metta. You don't need to store it up and apportion little bits out to different people. You know, just be abundant with it. The more you give, the more you'll have. It's coming out of abundance. Overflowing, rich with metta. You know, you could pretend you're just like a king or a queen. These vast stores of metta. And you can just be generous with it. Be generous with your metta. Give it out. And he also calls, talking about metta as exalted. So it can mean all-pervading. But I looked up the actual word exalted in the dictionary, and the English word exalted is from the Latin to raise up high. So I like to think of exalted metta as, well, metta is the highest thing of value we have in this world. It's the height of what we're capable of, of as human beings. It's the best the world has to offer. And also in the dictionary, it says extremely happy. So not only is the best that human beings have to offer, as being the best that human beings have to offer, if you act out of it, it makes you extremely happy. Apparently, Bhante talks about metta as having an ecstatic quality. It raises you above yourself. And when you're raised above yourself, when you're raised to the heights of human experience, the heights of what a human being is capable of, you experience bliss and joy. Which I think is really wonderful, actually. Metta is exalted. It's the highest we have to offer. And when we experience the highest that human beings have to offer, we experience bliss and we experience true joy, ecstatic joy, exalted joy. Or in the words of the Oxford English Dictionary, we are extremely happy. And the other one is immeasurable. So you can't measure it. And for me, this has a connotation that you can't put a limit on it. You can't quantify it in ordinary terms. It's something so precious and so wonderful that it surpasses all limitations. It surpasses all attempts of the human mind to categorize it, to measure it up, to weigh it, to think that you've understood it. You know, so much in this world is just about what we can get and what we can own. And, you know, if I do this, then I want this back in return. Metta has nothing to do with that. It's of so much value, it's limitless. It's immeasurable. You can't quantify it, you can't portion it out. And you can't put a limit in it. It never stops. You know, you can never just reach the end of metta. It's immeasurable. It's huge, it's vast. And I always get the impression at this point in the sutta that the Buddha is quite enjoying himself. I think he quite enjoys talking about metta. I would enjoy talking about metta, particularly if I was enlightened and I just had it all the time. So you think he just enjoys talking about metta, so he carries on. And I like to think of the next book is it's kind of humorous, but it's also very serious. And you can think, well, the Buddha, you know, he really understood what metta was about. He really got it. He was it. He was just an embodiment of metta. He just let it flow through him, and there was no limits to his metta at all. You know. So he had this really, one could say, even exalted vision of what metta is, and he's trying to communicate it, and try and really get an inkling of what it might be like to experience enlightened metta. He really goes into the nature of metta. And the first thing he says is, suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and tried to get rid of the earth by digging, spreading the soil here and there, spitting and urinating, saying, be without the earth, be without earth. So I don't know why urinating on the earth would get rid of earth, but there we go. It was obviously a little bit of an odd man here who tried to get rid of the earth by spitting and urinating on it, but there we go. The Buddha says, you know, suppose someone tried to get rid of the earth. Would he be able to get rid of the earth? And the disciples of the Buddha say, well, no. The Buddha says, well, why not? And he says, well, because this great earth is deep and immense. It cannot possibly be made to be without earth. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. And the Buddha says, so too should you train your metta to be like the earth. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So you can see I have a little diagram, and that funny little thing with the house and the trees and the roots and the bone is the earth. It all becomes clear. It's not about burying a dinosaur, no, it's just the earth. Okay, it's pretty hard to draw the earth, so anyway. So in a way you can really reflect on the nature of the earth. Because I think what he's saying is, the Buddha's saying, well, metta isn't sort of nicey-nicey or airy-fairy. It's solid. You can stand on it. You can rely on it. You can't be pushed around. It makes you firm. I remember once a friend of mine, there was a very difficult situation in Leeds that I was involved with someone who was in an abusive relationship, and it was all very long and complicated. But at the end of it, it was kind of like the Buddhists had to be called in and sort it out. And I remember my friend sitting there, and she looked at me long and hard, and then she said, God, Buddhists are no pushovers, are they? You know, metta is not being about being a pushover. It's not about being airy-fairy and sort of, mwah, mwah, I love you, darling, you know, but with no substance to it. No, it's like the earth. It's deep and immeasurable. You can rely on it. You can stand on it. That's metta. Metta means that you're reliable, you're capable, you're firm, you're unshakable. You're unshakable in your kindness. Irene came out with a great phrase last Mitch study, and she said, she started talking about muscular compassion, which I thought was such a brilliant phrase, so I think we can add that, you know. It's talking about muscular metta, like the earth, you know, not pushover, but solid, dependable, trustworthy. And then the Buddha says, well, he says, suppose a man came with some paints, wanting to paint pictures in empty space. Could that man draw pictures on empty space? And the disciples say, well, no. And he says, well, why not? And he says, well, because empty space is formless and invisible. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. And the Buddha says, so too should you train your metta to be, like empty space, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So this one's a little bit more obscure. And the handout shows paint pots. Paint pots and a paintbrush trying to paint in empty space. That's what that means. Just thought I'd clarify that for you. So he says, you know, make your metta like empty space. So what does that mean? Well, I think it means that you can't mark empty space. You can't stain empty space. You can't poison empty space. No one can affect you. No one can make you react. You just kind of slip through their fingers. So no matter what they throw at you, it just doesn't stick. You know, there's nothing there to make it stick. There's a line in Marcus Aurelius, who's an old Roman emperor. And he says, no one can implicate me in ugliness. So in a way, well, that's what we should be aiming for with our metta. We should be aiming for our metta that no one could implicate us in their ugliness. You know, no matter how much they throw at you, it just drifts off. So space, you can't capture it, you can't stain it, you can't paint it. And at the same time, it's all-pervading, boundless, infinite in all directions. So I think also you can think of space as having no personal agenda. There's no, you know, sometimes we can get into discussions with people and we've got a really fixed idea about where we want to go with it. So, you know, we've got it all planned out in our head, and then we go and see them, and then we just go, rah! And there's just our scenario, and we're just going to tell them what we think, you know. So empty space is a bit different from that. There's no kind of personal agenda. There's a woman called Lochner who does NVC training, and she gave a talk on a national order weekend that I went on. And she started talking about blue sky communication, which I thought was quite interesting. And she was saying the best communication that she has is when you leave behind your own personal agenda. You leave behind this whole plan of what you're going to say. And just be open to whatever the other person says and wherever the other person is coming from, and just respond appropriately. So if you do that, if you leave behind this huge personal agenda, well, well, then the conversation can really go somewhere. But if you have this huge personal agenda, if you have this whole story about what you're going to say before you even go to meet that person, it means that you've put a real limitation on the conversation. And you're not really speaking to the other person themselves. You're just speaking out your own plan. So you could look at meta as empty space, as being like blue sky communication, leaving behind your own personal agenda and just being free to move in any direction. So another analogy the Buddha has, he says, well, suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and tried to burn away the river Ganges. Could that man burn away the river Ganges? And they say, well, no. And he says, well, why not? And they say, because the river Ganges is deep and immense, and eventually that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. And the Buddha says, well, so too should you train your mind to be, like the river Ganges, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. So metta is like the Ganges. It's deep and immense. And you could think about the river Ganges, well, as you could think about the floods in Sheffield in June, actually. And the thing about a great body of water is it just pushes out any obstacles. You know, you can think of a tame little river, but a river like the river Ganges is a big flood, basically. And even heavy obstacles are lifted up and moved away. So it picks up any blockages. And if it gets stuck, well, it just finds another way round. It's a freedom of movement. It always finds a way through a situation. So metta is like the Ganges. And then the Buddha says, well, suppose there was a catskin bag that was so well rubbed that it loses all rustling and crackling. And a man came with a stick trying to make it rustle. Could he make it rustle and crackle? So this is where you get into the, what's a cat skin bag? Is that a small little kitty cat skinned or rubbed smooth? I don't know. I mean, one assumes he just means a leather bag, not made out of kitty cats. Did they have little kitty cats in ancient India? I really don't know. They did? That's very unfortunate. And I hope that you're all vegetarians. And if you are, don't look at my picture of a cat skin bag. It's not a hen, it's a cat. So what he's saying, okay, so you've got, basically you could think about it as a leather bag that's so well rubbed that there's no, it's very smooth, very well worn. Could you make it rustle? Could you make it crackle? And the disciples say, well, no. And he says, well, why not? Because the cat skin bag is so well rubbed, so soft and silky, that no one could make it rustle or crackle. And the Buddha says, so too should you train your mind to be like a cat skin bag, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So, yeah, okay. I don't know what a cat skin bag is. It's probably something completely different, but anyway. My reflections on this is that metta is a bit like being smooth. You don't react, you don't prickle up, you don't rustle or you crackle. Whatever anyone says to you, you remain smooth. You remain unruffled even. And it reminds me actually of what old people can be like. They're not always like this, but they can be like, even an ideal kind of picture of an old Buddhist master. Sometimes you get these pictures, particularly Chinese and Japanese pictures, of these very worn-looking old men who are very peaceful, and they're sort of worn smooth. They're worn smooth by time, and they don't react. You know, they've just got this enormous perspective. Nothing's going to rustle them. Nothing's going to crackle them. And there's an analogy for the Sangha, which is like a stone tumbler. I don't know if you've heard this before, and it's a bit like we're all these little jagged pebbles, and we're all in this stone tumbler, so we're all just knocking our sharp edges off each other and wearing each other smooth. And what ends up is a very, very smooth stone. So maybe that's what he's saying. It's like, okay, well, you rub up against each other and you knock each other's sharp corners off, and then you become smooth, you become unreactive. So then he really gets to the point of the sutta after this. He gives the main simile of the saw, which is a very, very famous simile. And he says, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. You should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no unskillful words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of metta without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with metta, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with metta, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So even if bandits were to saw you limb from limb with a two-handled saw, I don't know why they're so specific about how many handles the saw has, but there we go. So this is a really challenging teaching, actually, because it's saying that you're not a Buddhist, you're not following the Buddhist teaching if you ever respond with anger, no matter what anyone does to you. So some of you will leave you feeling really inspired. For some of you, that you'll think, oh, that's so inspiring. You know, it's possible to just respond with metta, whatever anyone does to me. And some of us will find it very difficult, actually. And some of us may have had very, very difficult things happen to us in our lives. And it might just feel like one of those teachings where you think, well, not only has something really horrible happened to me in my life, but actually I'm now made to feel guilty because I'm angry about it. Which, you know, it's a fair enough response, actually. So I'm just going to say a few things about forgiveness. It's a very tricky area to approach this. And I did actually have an experience of being in the shop and someone saying to me, she just came in off the street and she said, well, you know, I'm really inspired by Buddhism, but I don't think I could practice Buddhism. And I said, well, why not? And she said, well, I read that the Dalai Lama said to just forgive whatever anyone does to you. But I got gang raped when I was 13. And I can't forgive them, so I can't be a Buddhist. And, well, that really kind of shocked me, actually. You know, it's very easy to stand up saying, well, metta is like, you know, you just forgive anyone whatever they do to you. Because that's not easy for someone in that, particularly that extreme situation. So I think what's helpful is to distinguish between daily forgiveness and what I'll call radical forgiveness. So in daily forgiveness, you can use forgiveness as a practice. The Buddha talks about this. He talks about training the mind in different contexts. So you start with small things. You know, we all have our likes and dislikes. We all have our petty annoyances. I was trying to think of mine, and I have to say, as Suri Massey will know this, that mine is waste paper. I just get really annoyed when people waste paper. I can't help it. I just get really, really annoyed. So, in a way, well, that's my daily forgiveness practice, is not fishing bits, old envelopes out of the bin when we have a stack of about 1,000 of them. You know, just don't fish it out of the bin, just leave it, just recycle it, you know. So those are kind of stupid little things that we can do every day, just the letting things go. In every situation in daily life, if someone says something that winds you up, if someone does something that winds you up, you just got to think to yourself, well, can I let it go? And if someone says something a bit out of order, or they say something that's a bit thoughtless or even harsh, just think to yourself, well, can I just forgive them? Maybe you need to take it up with them later, but can you just forgive them, even if you need to do that? And that's a kind of daily practice of forgiveness. You know, start with the small stuff. Start with just our likes and dislikes, just not getting our own way, not just getting what we want. Can you just let it go? Can you just forgive them? Can you let that anger go? And the next point is about radical forgiveness. So I think radical forgiveness, the first thing to say is it comes out of a practice of daily forgiveness. You know, start with a daily forgiveness and then radical forgiveness can come out of that. So radical forgiveness is when what we need when people really have done terrible things to us, or maybe done terrible things to someone we're close to us, who are close to us. And maybe actually it's you who did the terrible thing. It could be you, it could be someone else. It's those really burning, deeper issues. And what you can look at this sutta is doing in that situation is it's pointing out a greater vision. Because I think if you've got something terrible has happened to you in the past, or you've done something terrible in the past, then you need to look out at a greater vision, and you need to look out at the possibility that actually we can be completely free of the past. We can be we can stop being defined by the past utterly. And maybe that will come at enlightenment. Maybe it won't come before. But it is a real possibility for every human being to be completely free from the past, so that it doesn't condition you, so that it doesn't affect you, so that it is just a thing that happened. You know, it's not this burning issue anymore. You can just let it go and it stops defining you. And that really is a possibility. So what this sutta is pointing to is that that's where metta can really reach. It can go that far. And maybe it hasn't gone that far now, but it is a possibility. You can let go of the past. You know, Buddhism is a path to liberation. And Buddhism is a path to liberation from your past. And it's possible. That is possible. You don't have to always be defined by your past. And it's not that you're going to necessarily make that past different. It's not good that you're going to make that past better. But you can make it so that your past is just something that happened and you're free of it. So there's a really good book, actually, called Challenging Times. And there's this interesting article, the first one, by Marion Partington, whose sister Lucy was killed by Fred and Rosemary West. And she quotes a woman whose daughter was murdered, and it's a very interesting quote, this. She says, "Forgiveness means giving up hope of a better past." Well, forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. So that's radical forgiveness. Radical forgiveness is an insight practice. Radical forgiveness is actually what happens when you reach insight, when you see the world as unsatisfactory, impermanent, and having no fixed or separate reality to hold on to. When you really understand that, when you really understand the nature of the world, the only answer is to just forgive it. John Middleton Murray, who's a literary critic who did some, in his book about Keats, he says, "There's this other kind of forgiveness which forgives not only men, but life itself, not only the pains which men inflict, but the pains which are knit up in the very nature of existence." So radical forgiveness is when you don't make the past better. Maybe you never resolve it, but actually you learn to just forgive life itself. You stop hoping, you stop wishing for a better past. You just accept what's happened as having happened. And it's not good. You didn't want it to happen. It's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. But it happened. And that's what life, that's what happens in life. So radical forgiveness, radical metta, in the face of any sort of torment, is built on a daily practice of forgiveness. And it's also been built on insight into the nature of reality, into the real nature of other people. And it's an insight into the fact that you really can't get what you want in the world. The world by nature is impermanent and unsatisfactory and devoid of fixed and separate selfhood. So in a way, if something's really bad has happened to you in your life and you can't forgive it, well, maybe you won't until you get to a certain level. But the main thing to hold on to now is that you can. You can get to that level. There is a place in metta. There is the potential in metta to completely be free of your past and to stop being defined by it. But it's not about making the past better. That kind of metta is actually just seeing into the true nature of reality as being impermanent, unsatisfactory, and devoid of real selfhood. So I'll just wrap up. I've probably gone over time, actually. But when I was studying with Bhante Sangharakshita a couple of weeks ago, and he started to talk about the importance of reflecting on the mystery of the Buddha. And the reason I like this sutta is because it reflects on the mystery of metta. You know, do we really understand the height of where metta can really go to? Do we really understand just how far it can go? You know, the possibilities are vast. In a way, a full expression of metta is enlightenment itself. A full expression of forgiveness is enlightenment itself. And when you're enlightened, the only answer is radical forgiveness. Really understanding the nature of true reality and forgiving it. So metta isn't just about being nice. It's not just about doing the metta bhavana and sort of feeling better at the end of it. It's about being amazing. It's about letting go of any trace of anger and ill will. And it's a real force for goodness in the world. It's abundant, it's exalted, and it's immeasurable. And this is the training. You know, the simile of the saw is the training. It's not there to just make you feel guilty because you haven't got there already. What the Buddha says at the end of the sutta is, he says, you should keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind. This will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. So what he's saying is that righteous indignation, anger and revenge will not make you happy, no matter how justified you think you are. But metta is like the earth, it's deep and immense. It's like space, it's unstainable. It's like a great river. It's like worn and smooth fabric that cannot be rustled or crackled. And it's metta that will really, really make you happy.